Welcome back to React Native Radio Podcast. Brought to you by parentheses, like children, to our great 10 our nightmare. Episode 187, TypeScript.
Hey everyone, welcome to the React Native Radio Podcast, where we explore React Native together. I'm your host, Jamin Holmgren, and I'm joined today by two of my prodigious. Is that how you say it?
Prodigious.
Like as in a prodigy?
Prodigy, yes. I'm sorry, I don't use this in normal conversation. I just looked it up. But my co-hosts, Harris and Robin, Aditi isn't here today. Harris, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. Are you still in Montreal?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. Well, we'll follow you around your travels once you get moving again. But so far, you've been staying put.
Once they lift the curfew, we're under curfew. If you walk out past 8 p.m., you can get a $6,000 fine here. So
$6,000 fine. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, they don't mess around up there. Robin, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great, Jamin.
Good. And I am very excited to bring on board Arda Therox, which I believe I butchered correctly.
Yeah, that's perfect. You got that just right. Thank you, Jamin. Welcome to be here, everyone.
you're very kind. I'll do a little more intro of Arda here. He's kind of a legend, but I'll do that in a bit here. This episode is sponsored by Infinite Red. We are a premier React Native design and development agency located fully remote in the USA and Canada. We have years of React Native experience, deep roots in the React Native community. We are the hosts of Chain React. We publish a React Native newsletter, and we, of course, do the show. Infinite Red is the best choice for your next React Native app. Hit us up at hello@infinite.red. If you want to, you can just email me directly, jamin@infinite.red. Learn more on our website, infinite.red/react-native. Awesome. So, yes, I want to introduce Arda. I've known him for, or at least of him, and then certainly I met you, boy, it was probably 2014, something like that.
Yeah.
Back in the RubyMotion days, one of the most prolific, I was going to say prodigious, and I don't even know if I said that right, prolific open source contributors on GitHub. In fact, you let us know, which is amazing, that GitHub even follows you on Twitter. This is how important you are to their ecosystem. I think if Arda stopped working, then pretty much all of open source would stop.
Yeah, that would be the end of the iOS community, the end of the TypeScript community, yes. React Native.
Everything. And it's pretty cool to have followed your career as you go through. And of course, part of that was you worked at Artsy, and a big part of Artsy's culture is working in open source. You were able to do it kind of almost full time.
Yeah.
With the work that you were doing over there. So very cool. Awesome to have you on the program.
Thanks. Honored. You know, a lot of this stuff is just like working on the community, and community work is some of the most like satisfying work for me. You know, for a lot of people, there is, you know, they have hobbies. My hobby is programming, and, you know, being able to do that with my friends. So fun.
Yeah, totally. And you've been into React Native, of course, which is something that we're obviously going to be talking about on this program. I met you again 2019 at React Native EU in Poland, where you were there. Did you give a talk there?
Yeah,
you did.
I gave a talk on like Xcode and all of the different build systems involved in native programming on iOS.
I have definitely watched that talk on YouTube.
Yes.
Yeah.
I actually make people watch your talk because it was so good. So I shouldn't have even asked the question because that's one of my favorite talks. So I do recommend people check that out. Artist talk in React Native EU 2019, where he talked about Xcode. You're going to learn a lot more about Xcode in 30 minutes than you ever thought possible. So go check that out. So, but we didn't necessarily bring you on just for your React Native experience. You're also on the TypeScript core team now, working at Microsoft on TypeScript. How did that come about?
It's a React Native issue, actually, at root. Me and the team at Artsy, we were a bunch of native developers at the time wanting to use React Native. We wanted to use React Native so that we could get access to Relay. And we were willing to put in whatever work it was to get access to basically that library. And we were sort of looking through all these different like flavors of JavaScript and actually opted for Flow. And I started trying to make a few commits to Flow and really, really struggled with OCaml and trying to, you know, sort of own that dependency is the term that we use, like Artsy, mm-hmm. which is, you know, if you're going to depend on something, you should be able to like contribute and improve it yourself.
I like that.
And we just realized that that was just not feasible with Flow for us. So we took the work to get React Native and TypeScript working together. This predates TypeScript and Babel support. So in order that we had to build this sort of multifunctional chain, tool chain that would go from TypeScript, that would generate something that Babel could then kind of use. Mm-hmm. You know, we wrote the docs for TypeScript support in React Native. And eventually it just sort of, TypeScript just became this language that really felt like what I believed programming language should be. Like sometimes it's too strict, sometimes it's not strict enough, and you get to choose when you want that. Like a lot of programming languages, they just offer this sort of box that gives you like a certain like experience. TypeScript has over 100 compiler flags that give you this really like mixed project feel because of the way that it can be added incrementally. Very of a programming language and environments that we give you that kind of, you know, use as much strictness as you want feel that really like resonated with me for TypeScript. And, you know, how I ended up on the TypeScript team is like, it kind of felt like a good time to leave Artsy. I'd been there for about 8 years. And I was looking around at all these different like large ecosystems. And it was very obvious, like to a somewhat insider on sort of like lots of large tools, that everyone was moving to TypeScript. Yeah. But that like TypeScript sort of, the set of people that work on TypeScript are compiler engineers, not necessarily the sort of people that are like out talking to people, seeing how they are obviously talkative and interesting, fun people, but what they don't care about as much is like the documentation, onboarding process, like deep migration strategies, working with all these other communities simultaneously. And I pitched to the TypeScript team that like, this is what I do. I've done this in multiple massive developer ecosystems, and I would be very interested in helping TypeScript scale. Because, you know, you look at some of the results of something like the State of JS survey that came out yesterday. You know, this is very bleeding edge people of the sort that respond to a survey like this one specifically.
Yeah.
But 70% of people say that they use TypeScript. And like JavaScript is one of the 70%. Biggest. 70%. And their customer satisfaction on that was like 90%. Like 90% of people would reuse TypeScript of the 70% of all code bases are using it.
I think I know the few people who don't like it. but everybody else
They're
does.
Very vocal on Twitter.
And honestly, for us, that's totally okay. We like TypeScript was never about taking over the entire JavaScript world. It was about providing great tools for the JavaScript world. And, you know, they might not like TypeScript, but I'm willing to bet they're probably using TypeScript's tooling under the hood. That makes them a user.
I find it kind of funny when people say, I don't like TypeScript, and VS Code gives me everything I need. I'm like, well, what do you think VS Code is using under the hood?
That the answer is they're a TypeScript user. They're just on the loosest possible interpretation of TypeScript.
Yeah, totally. And one thing that is just fantastic about TypeScript is because of that sort of practicality and the ability to just kind of progressively enhance your developer experience as you move forward into it. And that's something where I've gotten into, you know, fun sort of like discussions about how strict you should be with TypeScript. So one question I have for you is, when you look out now that you're kind of on the inside, when you look out across the landscape and you see people having all these arguments about how you should use TypeScript, what sort of, like, how does that make you feel? How does that make you kind of react?
I mean, you know, I'm now a very senior developer, so my answer to every question is the same, which is it depends, right?
It depends, exactly.
You know, there's just a lot of people with strong opinions. I know, but like, there's no other way. There's no other true answer. Like, you know, I would write with, here's a good example, right? TypeScript has always had a concept called strict mode, which I would say represents, you know, the types of code bases TypeScript would like you to build. Prior to the last two releases, we had never thought of stricter than strict mode things. We don't externally call it this, but like generally we tend to call them pedantic flags, which is like, I would like to put things in my way in a way that is not necessarily ergonomic, so that like we wouldn't recommend it to everyone. So TypeScript is actually shipping compiler flags for the sort of for folks that want to go even further than the TypeScript strict would be. So there's the spectrum here is massive. It is like JavaScript on one side, and it is now sort of pedantic mode strict, which is now even further than what you would think strict is. And all of that depends on the level of risk, how slow you want the project to potentially go. And I don't mean like compiler speed. I mean like, you know.
How long it takes a developer to ship a feature.
Yeah. Like if you have to be very certain about undefined, then that already slows you down a little bit. And that's, you know, what we generally say for strict mode. But if you have to be very certain, you know, that when you've pulled an object out of an array, that object exists, that slows you down even further. And you really do have to add additional syntax to that in ways that may be unnatural in order to make sure that you are guaranteed to be runtime free. So some of that's ergonomics. So again, yeah, no easy answer. The easy answer is always it depends on what you want. And unfortunately, that's not very satisfying. And it's definitely not like you can't have... It's not like a call and cry, right? Like, no, people would like to be like, you know, fighty on the internet, and telling someone it depends and on your project is not really a good way to, you know, get traction.
But I think that's one of the things that makes TypeScript shine so much, is because it's so versatile and you can really use it to the extent that you want. Because at its core, it's JavaScript, and if you want to basically use it as if it's JavaScript, you can. And that's kind of what I tell people when they're like, oh, should I switch? I'm kind of scared to switch. It seems like a big... I'm just like, okay, well, just write JavaScript then. Just like switch your files to .ts and just write JavaScript. And then just like try adding a type here and a type there. And eventually you'll see the magic and the value, but you don't have to like jump into the deep end right away, which I think is really powerful.
Yeah. A lot of the docs I've been writing recently are about like the migration strategy from JavaScript to TypeScript. And a lot of people don't really know that the first step is actually just to write a special comment at the top of a JavaScript file, like --ts check. And then you get the TypeScript type checker running on your JavaScript file. That's it. You literally can't add those type annotations because the syntax won't be allowed. But you'll get a lot of the power of TypeScript sort of strictness, but it will force you to only write JavaScript. And that's how you
actually
sort of get
people
to...
I didn't know that either.
Today I learned.
Yeah, man. Like, that's the thing, right? Like, you know, when we're documenting such a big system that, you know, 100 compiler flags runs in anywhere that JavaScript runs. So consider the scope of that. You know, most of the time we only think about Node or React Native or something like that. But like, you know, TypeScript runs on anywhere JavaScript runs, and JavaScript runs, what is it? I heard that people use JavaScript to maintain like spacesuits. Like Tesla. Tesla's car is JavaScript. That uses TypeScript. Like those environments have to be mapped in TypeScript in some way, because there's no way that you're going to run like JavaScript in those cases. Like you're going to be running it like guaranteed that you've got something. Wow.
Yeah, I really hope the space program uses strongly typed.
Yeah, I remember seeing a tweet about that. I was kind of shocked, but does anyone know how to what extent or how true that is, that they're using JavaScript on SpaceX?
Well, I definitely know in Tesla, but it was NASA that was using Node on
NASA was.
Yeah, wow. in this I think it was in the arm of the spacesuit for something. I mean, it could just be for like, you know, a small control thing, non-mission critical. They wanted to test the system. but it's there. It's out. It's literally out there.
That's pretty. There's like literally JavaScript in space. That's pretty cool.
Non-critical systems, right?
I hope so.
So speaking of the documentation efforts that you've been pushing toward, in August, you came out with a brand new TypeScript website, as well as branding, and you wrote a blog about it back then. That was a tremendous amount of work, I'm sure.
Yes.
And so do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I'll first talk about the logo, because that's the thing. That was the thing I really wanted to change most first. TypeScript, everybody thought this logo was TypeScript's logo, but the sort of blue square that looked like the JavaScript unofficial logo was not TypeScript's logo. And so I basically made it TypeScript's logo, but changed it just enough that Microsoft could retain copyright over it. The TypeScript website was a closed source website that only like a few people in the TypeScript team could edit. And I had quite a frustrating time learning TypeScript, trying to improve the tooling and documentation for TypeScript as an external person, which made it my first target, you know, open source it, take over the playground. Like if you'd been around TypeScript for a while, like the old playground was nothing like the new playground. It's like you could see the kernel of the idea in the old playground. All these people were building third-party documentation systems or third-party playgrounds, and just being able to take the time to like build an incredible documentation system that works offline, it uses Gatsby, it generates, mm-hmm. EPUBs and PDFs of all the docs so you can take them with you on the go. Starting to rewrite the handbook now, we're wrapping up the end of the new handbook now that's got all the new tools that we have for building documentation, mm-hmm. Because it's TypeScript, a lot of the type work is actually quite invisible. We now have the same hover systems inside the documentation as you would, in an IDE. And like a lot of mm-hmm. these things, no one's done before. So I didn't really have much mm-hmm. precedent to try and find, how do I do this stuff? And so I just had to build it all in TypeScript. And so, the TypeScript website monorepo is like 10 libraries that do all sorts of random things that nobody else has had to try do yet. And the entire website is now runs through the TypeScript compiler. So like every mm-hmm. code sample is guaranteed to be accurate and up to date in ways that like previously, prior to like me working on it, like they were pretty out of date. There was no reference to a lot of stuff. And now it's just mm-hmm. now it's stunning. I'm really proud of it.
I just opened up the handbook and it's super slick.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm doing the same.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's my design. That's my implementation. I also designed the React Native web homepage. If you've seen that,
yes, I forgot about that. that was really cool. So, let's talk really quickly about your React Native experience. Just segue into that for a bit, and then we'll come back to TypeScript.
Sure.
You said at Artsy you switched over from
native
from. Native code, even though I think you were, told me in Pullum, you weren't doing Android. So it wasn't necessarily because you wanted to go to like cross-platform, which is unusual. Yeah. Like most people go to it because of the cross-platform. But what was kind of your impetus to kind of move into React Native?
It was about the time that Swift was coming out in native world. Mm-hmm. And we sort of ran a sort of side experiment on a separate app that tested out Swift build tooling and what that would look like. And sort of came to the understanding that Swift was an incremental improvement over, building an Objective-C app, which is what we were doing at the time. And at the same time, we were looking at Relay. And I don't know, all of this literally was because of Relay. Like we were building these, JavaScript, JSON-heavy apps that just make this really it was a beautiful experience, but at the end of the day, we were just making a pretty JSON parser. And that's my unpolite way of describing, my app. and my general belief is that 90% of all non-game apps are probably pretty JSON parsers, right? They take an mm-hmm. API and they present it to you in some form. And like we found that Relay, I know this is the Relay podcast. It took the GraphQL, all the best bits of GraphQL, and it took all the best bits of building a really tight, React tree. And we were willing to build all the tooling for React Native, and go try and figure out this new language just so that we could test it. And we tested it on one screen and said we were just not going back from that. So from there, it was just React Native needed improving in different ways. And so I occasionally would contribute to core, and that was it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And one of the pieces of the React Native experience is obviously you're writing JavaScript and JSX. But we started off doing that in 2015. We were writing JavaScript, JSX. Later, we wanted to, we saw TypeScript and we really liked what we saw, and it was something where you get to bring back in the static analysis of your code that was helpful without necessarily having to go to a brand new language, completely different language. You know, it was still JavaScript at its core. And so that's why we ended up switching over in, I think, early 2017. So we've been doing it for 4 years now.
I barely remember doing plain JavaScript.
Yeah.
I didn't do it for very long because I switched from Ruby, and then we adopted TypeScript pretty soon after that. So I know TypeScript better than I know JavaScript almost.
That's so funny to hear because I started using JavaScript in 2005.
Yeah, same.
And you know, jQuery and went through all those iterations and stuff. And you know, for me, like TypeScript and how I like to do TypeScript is I like to show, and this is, there are many different philosophies, but mine is like, I already know how to write JavaScript. I can already build apps in JavaScript. I can do a good job building apps in JavaScript, but TypeScript brings the experience up. And so every kind of flag that I enable, every little thing that I do, you know, it needs to kind of be in service to that, like, you know, and not get in the way, but also help me. And I've found that for the most part, it's fantastic. You can just start by just enabling it on JavaScript files and see what it does, yeah. You know? And then when you need to start annotating to give hints to the compiler and type checker, then you kind of move that direction. And pretty soon you're sucked into it. Like, okay, I'm typing all the things.
I'll try and do just a plain JavaScript app. Like I did one the other day, just like I was doing a minimal repro for something. And I struggled. It was like every time I would compile it, something was wrong. Because I'm so used to TypeScript just like holding my hand.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, even on the compiler team, we still use JavaScript files that read so often. Mm-hmm. But we turn on that thing that makes you get the compiler settings. And it's just like you don't have the build step then. You can just run it straight away. Hopefully.
Is the compiler written in TypeScript?
Yeah, it's a TypeScript self-hosted project, so.
Perfect.
It's good to see what a compiler looks like. It's good to see what a TypeScript code base looks like at scale, right? Because, you know, TypeScript, for people that have never seen the code base, there is like a file that I think is 40,000 lines long in TypeScript. It might be 60.
Is that it?
It's one of those two.
Wow.
Well, we just the episode before this one, we were talking about organizing your source files into folders and stuff, and we talked about putting everything into one file as an option.
Yeah, is that a question? I can guess what that question is.
Actually, what I'm curious about, I've worked on a large TypeScript project, monorepo, and at some point, my type checker was just getting really slow. And I remember seeing a Twitter thread about like preferring interfaces versus types and other stuff like typing the return of a function. I wonder, like, since you're running such a large TypeScript project, how's that working for you? Is it slow or?
What's the TypeScript performance in TypeScript? It's actually not too unreasonable because TypeScript, the compiler, is actually built using TypeScript projects. So you might not have had to use this, but this is one way to really get your perf up, is to just sort of box off parts of your code base into different sub-projects. So working in the compiler, it only needs to know certain files. So like the scope of the amount of knowledge it needs to have is drastically reduced.
One thing that's kind of interesting about TypeScript is that it came into this ecosystem that was already very well developed. And so you had to have a way to type libraries that weren't typed. And, you know, the definitely typed project was a big improvement. And there are features within TypeScript that allow you to, you know, declare a module. And you can say, you know, from this module, we have these classes and these functions, you know, and it gives tools that allow you to kind of back into types on your dependencies, which has been extremely useful for projects to adopt. Because if you had to wait for every third-party library to release types, it would just never work. Like, you would never be able to use TypeScript.
Other ecosystems have to do that. And some of the other... Some languages are now sort of copying TypeScript's approach. Ruby Free, for example, has similar types of types and allows for, definition files in a similar way. Python has a similar thing. Like, Guido, who created Guido Possum? Van Ossum?
Yep.
He now hangs out in the TypeScript meetings where we chat about some of these sort of things because he's now at Microsoft. You know, a lot of the problem domain is the same. Like, we're all trying to figure out how to map untyped languages to type systems, I guess.
That's a really big testament to the community, I think, like how crucial the community is to TypeScript success. Is how, like, yeah, how much we're relying on these completely community-driven type definitions for pretty much every library I've ever used. Like, I'll be like, oh man, this isn't typed. And then I'll like look and there's a definitely typed, like somebody added it. And I'm like, thank you.
Probably
for
ordered it.
You'd be surprised. I haven't added that many, but I initially built most of the tooling that powers the way that you can interact with definitely typed nowadays. So like,
interesting,
you know, definitely typed is one of the most active repos on GitHub, full stop. Like there is, we probably,
it's huge.
It's huge. Yeah. It was like 10,000-20,000 modules in there.
Yeah.
And like from our perspective, it is a full-time job maintaining definitely typed. So there is always a compiler engineer on rotation on definitely typed, either merging or helping out on like complex PRs. Cause like, you know, a change to React, that could have drastic performance implications all over the entire ecosystem just by merging something instantly.
This is the sort of thing that has led to TypeScript sort of quote unquote winning over Flow. You know, that sort of focus on the ecosystem. Also, the deep integration with Visual Studio Code has been amazing. And I think that that is cited often. I see it often, like, this is why I use TypeScript and this is why I use VS Code. It's kind of a self, you know, reinforcing cycle because of that deep integration.
Oh, yeah. It's easy to forget where the line is. And like all these features that I've gotten used to, I don't even know what's like pure TypeScript and what VS Code is giving me anymore, because it's all so seamless.
It's interesting that, like, I am still the maintainer of VS Code Flow. Like, I took over that one. We were using Flow back at Artsy because
no one wants to take it over from you.
Yeah, basically, I've been trying to get a release out, but they revoked my access. We're friends. It's not like any. I think it might be like a Facebook security thing or something. But like, you know, I really struggled to set up a great development environment, in part because I couldn't contribute then to the Flow code base and to get it set up with VS Code. But, you know, Facebook originally bet really heavily on Electron. And like that didn't work out very well, in part because, you know, like, you know, VS Code versus Electron is a really interesting technical debate. Like VS Code won on technical merit, which is a rarity in engineering world.
It's true. Yeah, because I remember using Atom, and I remember before that Sublime, which was not JavaScript. I think is it Python or something like that. But yeah, I used Atom for a little while, but there were some real problems with performance for sure. And not that VS Code doesn't sometimes have performance issues, but it's an engineering marvel, in my opinion, how they've been able to eke every bit of performance out of what they're doing there.
And how they just don't let extensions slow your experience down much. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you could have as many extensions as you want effectively, and like your autocomplete will feel slow and sludgy, but your editor probably won't. And that's the power of JavaScript. And it's also, and the scale of which like JavaScript can run, but also like, yeah, it is clever, smart engineering by the VS Code team. They know what they're doing.
My co-founder Todd Worth, he's been coding for 25 years, something like that. And to him, you know, the idea of Microsoft engineering was always like proprietary, very kind of almost developer hostile in some ways, you know, kind of had a really bad connotation in his mouth. And so it was like this is not I don't trust Microsoft is kind of how he approached it. At the same time, as sort of a new generation of programmers has come on, as well as a complete, I would say, shift in philosophy from Microsoft.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much amazing Microsoft technology we are using in our day-to-day. It is like, I would not have guessed that I'd be basically working on a Microsoft stack all up and down.
Yeah. NPM, yeah. GitHub.
Right. Even React Native itself, Microsoft is one of the biggest contributors to React Native. I'm in the open source core discussions, and Microsoft engineers are right there kind of helping drive it forward. It's really cool to see how that has turned around.
Yeah. Another person from Artsy left to go work on the React Native team at Microsoft, and he maintains, you know, React Native for Mac. That's it. Like all of it.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Exactly. And it is kind of funny. Although,
React
obviously,
Native for Mac is a Microsoft product.
You know, Microsoft has always been the biggest third-party Mac app developer in the world. People don't realize that, but
Office. Yeah.
They've also done a really good job at not killing projects they acquire. Like, I almost forget that they now own GitHub and
LinkedIn. That's true. They've actually done a much better job with it than I would have expected. So when you're working on TypeScript, how do you know how to prioritize things? You know, there are a number of ways that you can gather feedback. You can obviously just listen to what's happening on Twitter, people complaining about stuff. You're actually extremely fast. I try not to abuse this, but you're ridiculously fast at replying on Twitter. And so once in a while I'll tag you and you'll just be like, oh yeah, you know, there's this, or maybe here's some, or maybe we should, you know, document that better or something. But I'm sure there's a never-ending list of things that you could add to, change about TypeScript. How do you kind of prioritize that in your day-to-day?
So, I'll answer this from two angles. One is like from TypeScript as a project, and I'll answer as myself. So TypeScript as a project has this sort of, it has a very small domain, actually. Like, you know, people ask us things all the time, and we just get to say, no, that's for TC39 to decide. Mm. You know, that like we care about the type system of TypeScript. We don't necessarily care about adding some new feature to JavaScript or adding that thing you want, which does make sense, and we would like it too, but it's got to go through TC39. And that is like, that actually narrows down the scope quite a lot. So then from TypeScript side, a lot of the headline features tend to be about taking existing design patterns that exist in JavaScript and finding a way to type that. So some of the key features that have come out in the last 6 months have all been about, you know, backtick strings and the ways in which you can generate strings at type time. Being able to create stringly typed APIs in a sort of elegant way. And, you know, no people probably came out a long time ago and asked for those features. But to build something like that, you have to build like 4 or 5 versions in advance, like all this infrastructure to eventually get to it. And so the TypeScript team sort of aligns every quarter, half year to try and get a sense of like what our longish term roadmap looks like to try and get some of those like hard things in. And then some of the team members are constantly on TC39 trying to get some features that TypeScript users really want. So, you know, the question mark dot operator, that the TypeScript team were the ones pushing that in the end. And that gave like a really great type system tool that actually is really useful for JavaScript developers regardless. And so from there, it is just like there's someone triaging full-time issues. So we always know what the bugs are and what feature requests look like. But then from there, it really is like everybody thinks of their own sort of key features. There's one person that does the JavaScript documentation, JS docs, syntax. There's some people that care about emit. That's our version. Our word is of transpile. Yeah, transpile. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've just focused on how do we make sure that the JavaScript that we ship is actually like as good as if you'd hand wrote it, which, you know, it can't be perfect, but it like that used to be like TypeScript's main goal was to show you the JavaScript and show you that Microsoft is not screwing with your JavaScript.
Yeah. Sure.
And then for me personally, a lot of the time it is pressure that I felt when I was an external contributor. And you know that still powers quite a lot of stuff that I do on a day-to-day basis now. I still talk to people that are building tools and trying to understand like what they are, where their pressure is building, and to try and sort of vent that in some way. Like the styled components changes recently is a good example of that. I tried multiple times to fix styled components in React Native, and every time like couldn't find an elegant answer. And then out of the blue, an internet rando, thank you for this, fixed it, figured it out. So I helped like, you know, guide that through the process, like make sure that everybody felt like it wasn't going to break the entire ecosystem. And now Styled Components works well in React Native and it works mm-hmm. well in Node. That's the other environment.
yes.
And so that's like venting pressure is generally what I mm-hmm. like. And that's how the TypeScript team can scale.
Yeah, I'd imagine a lot of the low-hanging fruit is kind of already been addressed.
Yeah, it's been 8 years.
It's a lot of, yeah, right? Wow. Okay. And it's been, you're really now working on long tail stuff, like things that are, you know, kind of, you're really pushing the bounds of what's possible with the type system.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a few things that come out, like I think 4.1 came out recently and it brought in the idea of being able to type using string literals and being able to interpolate
string literals. Yeah. Yeah.
Other strings.
Template string literals.
Right, exactly. And there's a warning in there, like, you know, don't abuse this. Like, there's ways you can really slow yourself down if you try to do this too much. And sometimes it's better to just be a little more vague about your types and not, don't be too specific, just for performance reasons. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing though. Like, somebody that's not a, you know, senior engineer starts reading some of these release notes and they're just like, a tagged template literal interpreted string, and it just sounds like all pure jargon. And to some extent, it is pure. I mean, it's industry jargon, right? But like, you know, a lot of the major features that TypeScript ship, to some extent, mm-hmm. focused on DT and focused on allowing people to build this stuff so that these libraries are completely typed in a way that like you never see, and they never even actually affect the code you write on a day-to-day basis. And so it can be hard to write release notes and sort of try and describe these features in a way that says like, this actually probably isn't for you at all. This feature is in the language, but you probably might not ever need to use, you know, tag template literals or whatever. And that's totally okay.
I'm glad you brought that up actually, because I think for people who are beginners or less experienced, it can actually be pretty intimidating to read release notes and feel like you don't understand a single thing, and it can be tough, and you feel like it'll fuel your imposter syndrome a little bit. But I'm really glad you said that, because it kind of gives those people permission to be like, okay, it's okay if the release notes don't seem like they're for me, especially with a library like TypeScript, which is so mature. Of course the release notes aren't going to be like the day-to-day features, because those were added like 5 years ago.
You know, const a equals a string is now a string like, type that, yeah, that's
been in there for a while.
Yeah, but we have been trying in the last two release notes to try and explain from scratch for some of the things, rather than just be like, this thing builds on this thing that we built like 5 years ago. Read the release notes for that thing so you can understand the next build. But at the end of the day, yes, the release notes are somewhat targeted at the sort of people that could actually understand it, because, you know, they have to be. It could be feasible to do a beginner release notes and an advanced, and maybe that's feasible inside the website, but not necessarily in the release notes system that we have.
You're more likely to put something like cool and flashy and exciting that most users are going to actually use. That's more likely to show up in like a blog post or some kind of like other sort of more marketing style release.
Yes.
So yeah, don't feel bad if you don't understand release notes, kids.
For sure. We have to be the reference. That's the important part. We have to be explicit. We have to be exact, and we have to let people know exactly what and how it does.
Exactly.
Other people can have opinions on it, but we can't.
I noticed that it started with, if you're unfamiliar with TypeScript, it's a language that builds on JavaScript. That this is the release notes for 4.1, but it's actually like, this might be your entry point to TypeScript. Yep. This might be the first time you look at it, is you see, oh, 4.1. So, well, maybe I should finally take a look at this. And you go and look at it, and it starts with a paragraph about what it is.
Yeah, it's a tricky balance. It's like the same with all documentation, right? Like, you know, we could have hundreds of documents describing TypeScript in many different ways that change every release, because TypeScript subtly changes. But we have to make decisions on what to document and what to make references and what to, you know, consider tutorials, because that the needs of people change and the target audience shifts. Like, TypeScript used to be a very early adopter audience, so you could be quite technical in it. But nowadays, you know, those early adopters have brought in the rest of the sort of late majority, early, like late stage. And we have to make sure that we attack those people, attack those. We have to target those people. Sorry. That's the new
very
handbook.
Hostile.
Yeah. That audience, not a fan.
You're very transparent about your roadmap. It shows what's happening with 4.2 and when it's coming out, 4.3, when it's coming out, and also what's done, and there are links to each of the different things. There's a future part. I noticed the first thing in the future was investigate nominal typing support. I clicked through to that, and it was an issue from July of 2014.
Oh, yeah.
So this has been around a while. This is probably a tough one, if I had to guess.
Oh, it's a really tough one. It's like one of those, okay, just in case people don't know the difference between nominal types and structural types, which would make total sense unless you're a type person. The way TypeScript does types is that it says, you know, if all the fields in an object are the same, it is the same object. That's it. But if you write something like, you know, C++, Objective-C, Swift, Java, it doesn't matter if the class you make has the same fields. They are different inherently. So a rectangle having a position and a size is different from a playground having a position and a size. Well, that other one is the difference between the two is nominal. So we call that nominal typing. And TypeScript basically doesn't have that at all, because JavaScript doesn't have nominal objects, except when it does. That's what makes it tricky. Like, classes now that can have private fields, and those private fields create a nominal instance of something. Because it's not the exact same as any of a copy of the class in a way that JavaScript didn't used to have. So the semantics of JavaScript are evolving and changing. So thus the semantics of TypeScript have to evolve and change with it.
Yeah, that's. I'm glad there are very smart people working on that instead of us trying to bumble through. So I'm one of the maintainers of MobX State Tree, and one of the interesting things, and I think one of the superpowers of MobX State Tree, is the ability to use TypeScript to generate, or just infer, I guess, static types from our runtime type checker, which we actually check at runtime the types that are being fed into the model and make sure that they're the right type. And obviously, if you have to write it for the runtime type system and you have to write it for the static types, then it becomes kind of annoying. Luckily, some very smart people before I became involved came up with a way to infer that. But it's a few years old, and I'm looking at it, and it's not ideal. You know, the types that it comes up with feel kind of messy and hard to read and whatnot because of, you know, how they were implemented, I guess. Yeah. And I know that TypeScript has evolved. The challenge in front of me right now is learning enough of the new TypeScript to know how could we improve this type checking or this type inference. On the runtime types. And it probably doesn't help that it's also sort of a builder system where you're not defining everything all at once. You can actually build upon types or models, and you can, you know, I'm going to take this model and then I'm going to extend it, and that's going to be a new model. And every time you might define your properties first, but then you extend it and you define your actions, and then you extend it and you define your views. And so every time you're doing that, you're picking up previous stuff, and you have to be able to, like, okay, in this action, do I have access to this property?
Yep.
You know? So it's very, very, it's a very, very difficult problem. And it's been on my list for a long time to just be like, okay, I got to deep dive into TypeScript and figure this out.
Yeah. Like, that's the thing. TypeScript makes that sort of thing feasible, even if it might not necessarily be an optimal, like, thing to do, right? Like, TypeScript allows you to do anything, but, well, more or less, but it still has an opinion on what is easy and what is hard. In part because, you know, static type systems, it's structural type system, those things are really computationally expensive. Remember I said a nominal type system, right? A playground is different from a rectangle.
Sure. Right?
In order to know the difference between that they are different in a nominal type system, you can just say, oh, is the class name different? In a structural type system, we have to check every single sub-property mm-hmm. against every single thing. So mix that now with your inferred objects where we have to go mm-hmm. back through this massive tree, AST. So we have to go back through all these different bits of code to eventually get back to where it was defined. And then that mm-hmm. then has to come back out before we can start doing comparisons in every single part. And as you mentioned, it's multi-passed, right? So it's like each different part has different parts of the inference to run mm-hmm. through. All that is just extremely computationally expensive, and not even like fun computationally expensive that could go into Rust or Go or something. It's just like straightforwards. If this, then that. Next, if next, this, next, that. Next. Over every field.
Right.
And so TypeScript's always trying to be like, you know, you could use an interface instead of a type here, and then we could do less work for you.
Right.
But like, you know, We're trying to map JavaScript, and that's legitimate JavaScript. So TypeScript needs to find a way to describe it.
I suspect a lot of JavaScript, when people move to TypeScript, people write
JavaScript code differently. TypeScript. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so if you did JavaScript-y TypeScript, you're going to run into the edges much sooner than if you do it in a way that really kind of feels idiomatic to TypeScript itself. So it's almost like TypeScript really is, in some ways, its own language or its own kind of culture.
Yeah, culture's a good one. I think it pushes particular design patterns that require it makes those design patterns easier, so people are more likely to move towards them. Like, you know, the TypeScript website, we never try and force you in one design pattern or another. I never write classes. Everything for me is just functions and objects. Like, you know, TypeScript has ways of making it easier to do those things that will just make you do those things.
I think we would do ourselves a disservice if we didn't touch on the thing that most people probably tuned into this podcast to get an answer about. And this is referring to a specific member of the community who tweeted a few days ago or a week ago, a controversial opinion about generics and whether or not generics should have single letter variable names.
Oh,
so that's easy. From Orta himself, what's the right answer?
No. You shouldn't. You should use long names. I've slowly been moving all of the TypeScript documentation to use long names everywhere. I agree. You know, like, I sometimes use I as an index. Like, I think there's ways in which you can get away with it. But especially in our stage of giving you documentation, we should not be using very short generics in the way we describe things specifically, because so many people are going to see that, and you need. You know, it's like trying to not use this or that in a sentence in order to force people to not keep track of that thing that you were talking about all the way through multiple sentences mm-hmm. and paragraphs. We have to do the same thing for generics. And like, you know, generics on their own are intimidating. Like, mm-hmm. and mix that with then making it harder to actually interpret because it's now T's, U's, V's. It's just not worth it.
It took me a long time to really grok generics, partly because I would see them in documentation and it just wouldn't register to me what I was even seeing, because it's not clear that it's a reference to a variable, essentially.
Yeah. Like, I thought for a while when I was learning static typing, and it wasn't even TypeScript, it was, you know, previously, but I thought that T was some sort of magical
reserve
keyword or something. Yeah, I did too. Actually.
Me too.
And it seems to be a common thing. Like, oh, T is a magical thing. No, because it's literally like writing
it's
foo.
T. It's like T for type. Yeah. It seems like it's a magical keyword.
It's some type that someone else gives me. Yeah. It's a type that someone else gives me.
Someone's decided this. Yeah.
Someone else's type. And I'm going to then pretend like I know what it is. And, it would be nice if that's what it said, or it was just more
by
obvious.
By simply switching to a context-sensitive word, you can really communicate that, like, hey, this is literally just a variable. It's a placeholder for whatever mm-hmm. you're giving it, and you're going to pass it along to where it needs to go. But
I'm usually not, like, super dogmatic about specific, you know, rules. If I use I for an index, it's, you know, for I equals whatever. Most people know what that is. It's not going to trip people up.
I also use I for index.
Yeah, yeah. And then even like if I'm just using it, if it's in a small function that's like four lines long and it's I need an element and I call it EL for element. It's not going to kill anybody. It's okay.
If I map over like a collection of like users in my little map function, I'll do you.
If it's small. Now, if it gets bigger, then clearly it's just like Orta said, if you have to track it over the course of paragraphs, then you better have a better name than just you, know?
So like that was one of my first changes once I got like write access to the documentation. Like, you know, TypeScript has this thing called the utility types page and the advanced types page.
Yeah, I've looked at it.
And you know, it just made those not T U Z E. And I think it's just like an easy way of trying to decouple like the magic of generics to people. I mean, it's hard enough to get your head over the idea that these things are variables and that like so throwing
type variables,
Yeah, I agree completely.
I think it's a really important step in sort of moving TypeScript from early adopter, like really advanced users to more of a general audience.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago that I had to learn generics. Like I learned loads of people just had to learn them quite recently as more and more of these languages added it, because it's a really great idea. But
it really is.
It definitely is like a complication step on top of like what you previously used to have. Trade-offs.
Definitely.
Orta, I could definitely talk to you all day about this. I hope that you come back. This is actually your second time on the show prior to us taking it over and relaunching it. You were actually on with my business partner, Gant Laborde, as well as Nader Dabit back in the early days of React Native Radio. So appreciate you coming on again with us. And we're going to, if we can lure you back here again, we're going to hopefully get you back at some point. I know that there's a lot more to talk about with TypeScript. We barely scratched the surface.
React Native in general.
Yeah. React Native as well.
Didn't even talk about CocoaPod support in React Native.
I know.
CocoaPods. You're in everything. Yeah. There's no way that we can keep up with you.
Ran that dependency manager for a decade.
Ever heard of CocoaPods? Yes, this is one of the guys responsible for that.
This was very informative. I actually learned a lot in this talk. I couldn't contribute as much because I'm realizing how much I don't know about TypeScript, but thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
So I'm going to really quickly shift gears into a part of the program where we talk about weird bugs. Does anybody have a weird bug they want to bring up? Doesn't have to be about TypeScript.
I have a weird bug. Fundamentally, it's not really a bug. It's just a feature that doesn't exist. But it manifested as a bug in the application that we're building. And it's related to UIKitten, which is a component library that we've been using. And using UIKitten, specifically their popover component, which is basically a tooltip or a like where you click a button and another component pops up. Using that popover component with React portals. So if you're not familiar with React portals, it's a feature that allows you in React.js to essentially insert a div at the end of your document. And we're using it in order to basically display a full screen modal on top of our entire site content. However, the screen content that we're putting inside our portal had a popover in it. And the bug that was filed against our app was that they just don't open. Like you click, nothing happens. So I went and I did a minimal repro to show the UIKitten team. And apparently it's just not a feature that exists. They just aren't compatible. They don't work together. And the reason is that UIKitten relies on what they call an application provider, which is at the root of your app and basically acts as like a host for the popovers and the sort of components that are sort of inserted. But because of the portal, we were outside of the application provider. So what was happening was the popover was rendering behind the modal in the regular app. And so it was there. It was like it was popping up, but you couldn't see it. And so after talking to the UIKitten team, what they would need to do is basically expose this like modal host service so that you can use it in other places besides your main application provider.
And Zindex 9000 didn't work?
It didn't. I tried that.
And this is kind of one of the things. We're using UIKitten, which is actually fundamentally a React Native library, but we're using a React Native web. Yeah. And so we're in a context that they don't generally use it in. And yeah, that was a fun one.
We're pushing the library forward.
Yeah. So I think you fixed it, Robin, by just kind of writing your own.
I fixed it by not using popover, unfortunately.
Yeah. Nice. Working around it.
Working around it. I'm sure they'll fix it eventually. We did that mostly just because the UIKitten team just doesn't have time to prioritize it at the moment. And yeah. I think they probably will work on adding it. And so we may be able to go back to using their popover.
Yeah. And I do have to give a shout out to the UIKitten team. Yep. They were very, very friendly to talk to. Very cool people. I think they're based in Belarus, and they're good people.
Yeah. Yeah. They've been great to work with. They helped us solve a couple other issues with our bundle size. Our web bundle size was like 10 megabytes or something ridiculous because we were adding a custom theming, and we met with them and they pretty much instantly got us the right configuration to reduce that bundle size down to less than one, I think.
Yeah, this is one of those things, by the way, where like we're using an open source library, and we ran into a problem, and we could just file an issue on the GitHub and then, you know, complain, grumble internally that, oh, they're not fixing it or whatever. But I was just like, you know what? If we have to pay them to fix this, like, that's worth it to us. So,
well, and I could have easily just like worked around it and
moved on.
And sort of rolled my own custom and not even like talk to them or let them know. But now like they know that there's an issue and they have a plan to improve the library. And so even though I'm not taking advantage of it quite yet, I feel like we've done good service to the community.
Very cool. All right. Where can people find you? Ordo, you said you're just at ORTA on Twitter?
Yeah, Twitter and GitHub and Instagram, though my Instagram is a little bit abstract. I'm like a day one user of it. I just don't write. Yeah, I just take pictures of walls and things like that. It's like patterns. Mostly on Twitter.
Instagram is a very different community than Twitter.
And that's a good thing. Harris, you are at Nomadic Spoon.
Yes, that's right.
And Robin, at Robin_Heinz with an E. You can find me on Twitter at Jamin Holmgren, also on GitHub. I do not have as impressive of an open source profile as Orda, as much as I try. And as always, thanks to our producer and editor, Todd Wirth, our transcript and release coordinator, Jed Bartoski, and our social media coordinator, Missy Warren. Thanks to our sponsor, Infinite Red. Check them out at infinite.red/react-native. And a special thanks to all of you listening today. Make sure to subscribe and tell a friend. They're definitely going to want to listen to this this episode. Orda has always been an open source hero of mine, so I'm really happy to have him on the program today. Thanks so much.
Welcome.
All right. See you all later.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Ciao.